Boris Johnson's days appear to be numbered, as the UK Prime Minister is expected to make an announcement today about his future in power. Plus, as copper loses its value, what does that mean for the broader economy? And Russian natural gas cuts send Europe racing.
I think it's a big question. What happens when country A is under pressure to give natural gas to country B that needs it even more?
It's Thursday, July 7th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Here's the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson is expected to announce today that he will resign from office. That follows an exodus of his lieutenants who quit his cabinet in recent days. Stephen Fidler is the Wall Street Journal's bureau chief at large based in London and says the resignations left Johnson with practically no ability to govern.
The government was in a state of complete paralysis, with many departments really having very few political leaders and ministers. So the government effectively couldn't govern, it couldn't legislate. Mr. Johnson was in effect in office, but not in power.
Johnson became prime minister in 2019 and led the United Kingdom out of the European Union through Brexit. He was also credited with a successful rollout of COVID-19 vaccines in the country. But Fidler says there have been several instances that led people to question the prime minister's honesty, including a series of parties held at 10 Downing Street while the country was locked down. As for what comes next, Fidler says that Johnson may announce that he won't leave office immediately.
The officials say that he will say, I won't go immediately, that I'll wait until the Conservative Party has found a successor, and that could take several weeks or months. So he will probably be sort of effectively in office until perhaps even September, ahead of the Conservative Party conference that will take place.
You can read more about this story as it develops at WSJ.com. A Uvalde, Texas police officer had a school shooter in his rifle sight, but did not fire because he believed he needed permission to shoot. That is according to a new report by Texas State University's Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center. The Texas Department of Public Safety commissioned the center to evaluate the response to the May shooting that left 19 children and two teachers dead. The investigation found that a police officer could have fired at the school shooter before he entered the building, but did not get the authorization because his superior either did not hear the request or did not respond in time. Uvalde's police department did not immediately respond to a request for comment. And we are exclusively reporting that Merck is in advanced talks to buy cancer drug maker Seagen. A deal which could be finalized this month could be worth at least $40 billion. The purchase would help protect Merck's role in the cancer drug sector. Its Keytruda immunotherapy drug is expected to lose patent protection later this decade. A deal is not guaranteed, and it's likely to draw a close look from antitrust regulators. Copper has lost some of its shine, with prices for the metal dropping to their lowest levels in nearly 2 years. And while that may be good news to the industries that use copper, like construction and electronics manufacturing, copper's drop could be a sign of a coming recession. For more on that, we're joined by Wall Street Journal markets reporter Caitlin McCabe. Hi, Caitlin.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So copper prices are down 30% at a time when other commodities are still flying high. What is going on here?
So copper did hit record highs earlier this year, in part due to the war in Ukraine and associated sanctions on Russia, which produces a lot of metals. But copper, like some other commodities, have seen their prices come down lately. And for copper, investors are worried about economic growth. We've seen data lately showing declines in manufacturing data and home building. And I think that there are real fears that as the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, it could tip the economy into a recession. And on top of that, investors are also concerned about a sluggish economic recovery from the COVID-19 lockdowns in China. So all of this has come together to make investors more bearish on copper. We've seen hedge funds and speculators in particular becoming more net bearish on copper, which means that there's been more wagers on copper prices falling than on copper prices rising.
And Caitlin, what is it about copper that some say makes it so predictive of the broader economy? Why should we be paying attention to this one metal in particular?
So copper is sometimes called Dr. Copper for its ability to gauge economic health. And that's because it's used in really everything from construction to electronics. And China, on top of that, accounts for roughly half of global copper consumption. So when investors are not feeling great about the global economic outlook and are particularly worried about China, commodities like copper suffer. But not everyone thinks that copper necessarily is a reliable indicator. There's one researcher out there who has pointed out that there have been times when it hasn't predicted recessions. And others, meanwhile, are also thinking that copper could rebound on a change in Fed policy or a recovery in Chinese demand. And so that's even led some portfolio managers to buy assets related to copper. So not everyone sees a recession.
That was Wall Street Journal markets reporter Caitlin McCabe. Caitlin, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Russia has reduced its supply of natural gas to Europe, leaving businesses on the continent scrambling to shore up their energy sources. So what happens if Europe starts having to ration natural gas? We'll look at that story after the break.
NetSuite by Oracle brings accounting, finance, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce costs everywhere. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/wallstreet.
It's summer in Europe, but countries are already scrambling to secure enough natural gas to keep homes warm and businesses churning this winter. That's because last month, Russia cut the amount of natural gas that it's sending to Europe. To be clear, Europe did vow to wean itself off of Russian natural gas after Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February, but in practice, doing so will take years. And in the meantime, the slowdown from Russia has sent a jolt through European economies. Matt Dalton is a reporter in the Wall Street Journal's Paris Bureau, and he joins us now with more. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Luke.
So these countries said they wanted to get off Russian natural gas, but I'm sure they didn't want it to happen like this. So paint a picture for us. What's playing out here?
Yeah, so Europe announced a plan this spring to reduce its purchases of Russian gas by two-thirds this year. And then within the next 5 years, stop buying Russian gas completely. What they didn't anticipate doing, or they hoped they wouldn't have to do, is to stop buying Russian gas completely this year, go completely cold turkey this year. And it's increasingly looking like they might have to do that because Russia did cut its shipments through the Nord Stream pipeline significantly last month. Shipments through other pipelines that go through Poland and through Ukraine have also fallen. Several European countries have already said that they're not going to buy any more Russian gas this year immediately. It's Poland, Finland, Bulgaria. So the supply disruption and the falling shipments have happened much faster than Europe anticipated. And so that's produced a lot of concern about how Europe is going to get through this coming winter without having outright shortages of natural gas.
I mean, what is the plan? Is there some sort of EU master document for what you do when there's a shortfall of energy supplies?
Europe has been doing planning over the past few years, particularly since the tensions with Russia really started in 2014 with the annexation of Crimea and its support of pro-Russian insurgency in the Donbass in eastern Ukraine. So Europe understood that something like this could come, that they would have to plan for some kind of reduction in Russian gas supplies. But the planning that was going on was not really suited to this kind of supply emergency that's been happening. So I think it's fair to say that Europe has been a little bit behind the ball in terms of thinking about how to share gas, for example, between countries. There wasn't really a plan in place to deal with this kind of disruption, maybe because there is no really real easy way to deal with this kind of disruption.
What happens if there is just not enough natural gas and, I don't know, rationing is going to be needed? How does the EU weigh who gets what? Is it businesses? Is it industry? Is it this country or that country? How is that all being sorted out?
So the rules across the EU basically say that, okay, households get first dibs on natural gas for heating as the weather gets colder. Also, certain institutions like hospitals, schools, a few other users, you don't want people to freeze for lack of natural gas. And then you're talking about industry. So which industries get priority access to natural gas? And that's where things get really difficult, because industrial consumers of natural gas are one of the main users of natural gas in Europe. You've got companies like fertilizer manufacturers who use natural gas both as a source of energy and as a raw material to make fertilizer. Then you've got the aluminum producers. They say, if we lose power abruptly because there's rationing of natural gas supplies and we won't get our electricity as expected, that could destroy our equipment that we use to make aluminum. So there are all these industries saying that we need to be first in line for the gas that is left over after you've kept households warm and providing it to hospitals and all those other priority consumers. And the trick will be, how do you distribute that to the different industries?
And what about countries, Matt? Are some of them jockeying for a position to get more natural gas than their neighbors?
They are. If you're a country like Austria, and you're landlocked, and you're not going to be getting the gas via pipeline that you normally get from Russia, you're going to be depending on other countries that have, for example, liquefied natural gas terminals on the ocean to send you gas. And if the country that, for example, France or Germany, that first gets that gas needs it for itself, then how do you share it onto Austria? And so these kinds of tensions are going to be cropping up. So EU regulations require countries to share gas with each other. They call it solidarity gas when there is no other option for a country to heat households and provide basic electricity needs. And so how that is going to play out and whether there will be enough gas for all the continent to do that without any Russian natural gas remains to be seen.
Matthew Dalton is a reporter at the Wall Street Journal's Paris Bureau. Matthew, thank you so much.
Thanks, Luke.
We should point out that news came out after we spoke with Matt yesterday that France has decided to nationalize power company EDF, with officials saying the government will take full control of the nuclear provider in order to manage its transition from fossil fuels, fuels like that dwindling Russian natural gas. And finally, gift cards. They may be convenient if you're in a hurry, though maybe not the most thoughtful present out there. But you know who really loves them? The companies that sell them. Mercator Advisory Group is forecasting that more than $1 trillion will be loaded onto gift cards this year. And as Wall Street Journal Heard on the Street editor Spencer Jacob tells us, that amounts to a very nice interest-free loan to a lot of companies.
So if you've prepaid for a company's product, then that creates a liability. It's a service or a good that they have to provide you in the future. It's a liability. But offsetting that liability is a pile of cash that you've handed them, and there are no restrictions on what they can do with that cash. And especially now with interest rates rising and inflation marching ahead, holding your cash is very valuable for a company. The prices are likely to have gone up by the time people spend it. And that's cash that they can use instead of borrowing money from the bank or issuing a bond. So having your cash with no interest attached to it is definitely better than going out and getting money in the commercial market.
And that's What's News for Thursday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.